So this evening I'm going to continue the series of talks I've given over the last 3 weeks on the topic of thinking. And maybe this will be the last in the series. We'll see. How many of you have come to at least one of the talks over the last Mondays? What I've tried to do over those of you who weren't here, what I've tried to have done over the last Mondays is to evoke a greater interest in your minds to pay attention to the realm of thinking, the world of thinking. And in particular, to be mindful of it. And I try to give some various ways of looking at thinking, the domain of thinking, the ecology of thinking, that could give us a little better handle on being mindful of it and becoming free of the world of thinking. Thinking is a very important part of human life, and it's also a big part of meditation practice. And mostly meditation practice is a matter of becoming free of it. So it doesn't kind of obscure our ability to see clearly, doesn't interfere with our ability to get settled and calm. In the context of meditation, thinking often keeps us agitated, caught up in the discursive world, caught up in things away from the world of settling and calming down that can happen and seeing clearly. So in the discourse or the teachings of meditation practice, the most common instructions in our tradition is to let go of your thinking. If you can't let go of it, then bring mindfulness to it to such a degree that the mindfulness helps you become free, independent from the thinking. Even if you can't get rid of it, it doesn't stop. You become free of it. And the goal in mindfulness practice is not necessarily to stop thinking, but to become independent of it, or not be caught up in the realm of thinking in its gravitational field. In a sense, it kind of step out of its gravitational force of thinking so you can have a much more objective, clear relationship to the world of thinking. So the most common thing, kind of instructions in simplified form, just let go of thinking. However, to let go of thinking in daily life, for that to be your only relationship to thinking would be a tremendous disservice, would be kind of violence to ourselves, because thinking is a very important part of human life, and it's a necessary part. And learning how to engage wisely in the world of thinking is a very important part of any life. And it's an important part of a Buddhist life. People engage in the Buddhist path. But it's not always obvious, partly because, again, we're a meditation tradition. Teaching and thinking is let go. But sometimes people will generalize from those teachings and generalize out into daily life as if you're supposed to let go and not think through all the time. Once when I was on retreat, kind of with another Buddhist teacher, a senior Buddhist, Western Buddhist teacher, I had the occasion to ask him a question, and I prefaced the question by saying, "What do you think about?" I forget what the question was. "What do you think about X, Y, and, you know, something?" And he looked at me very compassionately and said, "I try not to think." So, you know, there was something maybe in the context of him being on retreat, sitting meditating on retreat, maybe that was an appropriate response for him at the moment. But to generalize, that's a little bit dangerous, don't think. And I remember once at the Zen monastery, I was in charge of ringing the bells for the different services they have, the chanting, you ring bells and drums, and it's quite an elaborate scene. And I was called a Doan. And at a time when a visiting dignitary, Zen master from Japan, came to the monastery to visit. This was a big to-do in the monastery. And so we had a kind of impromptu or kind of service, chanting service, just for to show off, I guess, to this guy. And the abbot of the monastery changed the chants in the middle of the sequence. I don't know, he just changed it. And so that he's supposed to hit this wooden drum, for this new chant that was being introduced. But I was in the old schedule. No one had told me it was changed. So I wasn't prepared. So everybody started chanting this thing. You're supposed to keep the beat. Bum, 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 bum. You know, I didn't even have the drumstick in my hand. So suddenly they were starting going, bum, bum, you know. And I had to kind of scramble and find the drumstick and then I kind of had to figure out how to get into the beat. You know, everybody else was chanting. So afterwards I went and apologized to the abbot because, you know, I didn't know and I kind of messed up a little bit in front of this dignitary. And he was kind of angry with me. annoyed. And he said, I said something again. I said, I didn't think you were going to change. You know, and what did he say? Don't think. You know, it's not a matter of thinking. Somehow I'm supposed to intuit, you know. Now, to the credit of these teachers who say don't think, there is something very powerful about stepping outside of our thinking mind. Our thinking mind can keep us very limited, keep us in a very limited domain of experience, very limited domain of intuition, of processing information and what's coming in. And sometimes our thinking mind interferes with the whole fullness of the human mental processing, the way it can process things and kind of take something in and know what's the appropriate response, what needs to happen. That can certainly happen. However, again, you can get the impression you're not supposed to be thinking. Thinking is somehow bad. Can sometimes be an impression within Buddhism. But if you read the teachings of the Buddha, he was a great thinker. He was analytic. He was synthetic. He was discerning. He was constructive. He kind of engaged in the world of ideas or practice or the world as he experienced it. And really was very, very careful with his thinking process. And he taught, I think, a way of be very careful and systematic with how you understand the ideas that you engage in. A little bit more along this line of I've given teachings which maybe I gave in the last few weeks, that you don't have to believe your thoughts. And for some people, this is very, very helpful. Because some people never were kind of assumed that every thought you have, you're supposed to believe. And some people assume that they are their thoughts. And to say you're not your thoughts can be liberating for some people. Really, I'm not? Well, then who am I? So once on a retreat or in a one-day sitting, I said, you don't have to believe your thoughts. At the end of the day, someone came up to me and said, I grew up in a cult. And that's one of the things they told us. And I said, oops. And it was years before I dared say that again. You don't have to believe your thoughts. So again, the whole emphasis, don't think, don't think, don't think, that can come through, sometimes is an attempt to pass on something very profound that Buddhist practice can point to. And sometimes I can think it can be very unfortunate, and sometimes it can even be malicious, where it's, an attempt to kind of control people and don't think carefully. don't think for yourself. So some of you know that I did a graduate work in Buddhist study at Stanford University. And there were a number of motivations for me to do that. But one of the motivations stemmed from an experience I had in undergraduate college. As an undergraduate, I studied agriculture. And I went to UC Davis, a great agricultural mecca. And I was a kind of a born-again, organic agriculturalist, or a fundamentalist, organicist. And I was also a student activist for the alternative agriculture movement at Davis. So I was really into it. And then I started taking these classes, science classes, science of soil science and different things. And lo and behold, some of the things that I thought were true about farming and commercial agriculture and about organic farming, some of the things, not everything, but some of the things proved to me not true. The science was not behind it. They were generalizations that people had made, broad generalizations based on one little piece of evidence or something was true in a certain kind of way. It's true in certain proportions, certain degrees, it can be true, but not in other degrees. It's like, you know, if you said, oh, the sun is dangerous. Well, the sun is dangerous if you're out there at noon in a hot day and without any suntan lotion. I guess it can be dangerous. But to generalize from that and say the sun is always dangerous, you know, and so I'm going to lock myself in a bomb shelter, that's a generalization that goes, you know, beyond that, you know. So you have to understand the degree. So I was kind of a little bit humiliated, or humbled at least, chastened by this idea that I had believed something so strongly. And as I studied the science of it, it wasn't true. So then I came to study at Stanford, you know, religious studies. Well, I got involved in religion, you know, Buddhism. Buddhism is a religion, though I'm sometimes reluctant to admit it. And what I noticed is that religious people have a great capacity for generalization. Much more than organic farmers. And I didn't want to fall into the same trap again, make the same mistake again. So one of the motivations, I wouldn't have done it just for this reason, but one of the motivations behind studying religious studies at Stanford, Buddhist studies at Stanford, was in that I devoted my life to the religious life, to Buddhist life. I wanted to have the information and the critical thinking ability to be able to engage in Buddhist thoughts and idea, so I wouldn't do the same thing again. I wouldn't generalize. And to think critically and carefully what I'm going to say. Know the assumptions underneath what I'm saying. Know the purpose of what I'm saying. To have the information enough information gathered together to understand you know, what can be said. There's a whole realm of what can be called critical thinking that can be cultivated and developed. And I felt it was really important in the world of religion to do that. There's lots of examples where it's not present. So I went to Stanford, and the years I was there, early 90s, in front of the library, outdoors, they had the statue of Rodin thinking. They now moved, since then, I think, moved it indoors. But back then it was outdoors. And it's one of the great pieces of Western sculpture. This guy who looks like he's naked and he looks like he's having a hard time in the toilet. back then I thought, the way it was laid out there on the lawn, there was this long corridor lawn that led away from that statue. And the other end of that corridor of lawn that was empty. And I try to give serious thought about how I can get a similar sized Buddha statue of a Buddha sitting in meditation peacefully and to face Rodin's thinker. And the contrast of this thing, you know, this intense kind of thinking and the Buddha sitting peacefully, I thought was a wonderful contrast. Now, someone might, again, look at that contrast and say, oh, thinking. The West is all about thinking, and, you know, and we get these headaches, you know, thinking so hard. And the Buddha is about not thinking and being so peaceful. And at that kind of generalization, I don't think isn't accurate. The Buddha was a great thinker. But his thinking, you know, the image of him sitting in meditation is not necessarily one of sitting with an empty mind. Sometimes his mind was out without thought, that's for sure. But also was someone who was capable of great had a great capacity for reflection, contemplation, thinking, analysis, discrimination, discernment, motivation, you know, all this. And to really drive this home, this idea that Buddhism might give the false impression you're not supposed to think at all. Another teaching you find in Buddhism that's quite popular here in the West, some circles, is the teachings of just practice, don't know. That's all you need to do. There was a famous Korean teacher who said that was his main practice. Don't know. And have the not knowing mind. There's something very profound, again, about having a beginner's mind, about not knowing everything and being open. But again, it doesn't mean you have to stop thinking. When you come into a meditation hall, you're not supposed to check in your thinking at the door, at the counter. Although some of you wish we had such a counter. I'm sure. So, you know, the last 3 weeks has been a lot about how the traditional teachings about mindfulness in relationship to thinking. And the goal is to become freer of our thinking, to see it much more clearly, and then to see it more clearly to become freer of it. And as we become freer of our thinking and see it more clearly, it gives us opportunities to engage in thinking in new ways. And so there's three ways that I think the practice of mindfulness can help us engage in thinking in more helpful, wise ways, wise thinking. One is that the mindfulness can help us understand our relationship to the world of thought. The second is it can help us understand how we're thinking, something about the process. And the third has to do with help us understand the content of what we're thinking. So our relationship to it. So I mentioned earlier, some people believe their thoughts. Some people are driven by their thoughts. Some people believe they are their thoughts. Some people, have all these opinions and ideas about thinking. Sometimes some of them are nice and helpful, and some of them are very painful. One friend of mine described once the reason he started doing Buddhist meditation was he was really troubled by his thinking. And he wanted to stop his thinking or get rid of it. He was just really troubled by it. And after many years of Zen practice, he said, what happened was I didn't stop thinking, but I stopped being bothered by it. And that was for him the big shift that happened in him. So a new relationship to the world of thinking. So part of mindfulness can help shift our relationship to it. Once I sat a 3-month retreat, and I was interviewed at the end of the retreat by a Western Buddhist monk who had been practicing for many years, but he was a big-time thinker. So, I mean, for him, thinking was so, he was so kind of caught in the grip of thinking that even though months and months of long retreats, he couldn't really settle and get calm because he was just always thinking about things. So for him, he was a real struggle for him. Anyway, he interviewed me about my 3-month experience. And maybe because it was such a big deal for him, he asked me, Gil, what was your relationship to your thinking? And I said to him, I have a very friendly relationship to my thinking. And he just about fainted. What? But I did. I had a very friendly relationship to them. I didn't see them as being the problem or hindrance. They could be. But I also saw them being a support for the meditation practice. So the first is the relationship. So to look at that. And sometimes it's hard to understand what our relationship to thinking is. Sometimes our relationship is one that the world of thinking is going to be the solution for our life. That's where we find solutions. And so it's really important to think. So if that's your relationship to thinking, of course you're going to stay fully engaged, full throttle in the world of thinking, if you think your solutions for your life are going to be found there. Anyway, there's a lot to be discovered around the question of your relationship to thinking. The second is how you think. And even if you think about the most important, necessary thing in the world, the content is important and beautiful and beatific and whatever. The how you think is very important. And it could be that you're thinking with too much energy, too much intensity, so you're tiring the mind out. It could be that you're grasping and clinging to those thoughts. It could be that there's too much tension in your body as you do the kind of thinking. It could be that the emotions that are fueling and perpetuating and being stirred up by whatever you're thinking are not so good for you. And so even subtle chronic thinking about certain seemingly healthy themes, the way that we think might not be healthy. So, and sometimes because it seems like a healthy, important thing to think about, we might not notice how it is we're thinking in relationship to it. We're hanging on to everything as being so important, trying desperately to get, to the solution or something. So one of the things that mindfulness and meditation can help us do is to shift and change how we think. And that's where the image of Rodin's thinker and the Buddha meditating is such a nice one. Because Rodin's thinker, thinking is very important, but he seems really contorted, in my kind of way of looking at a sculpture, really kind of caught up and tense in his thinking. And I've learned that my thinking is much more productive and much more creative and much more wise, much more synthetic and intuitive when I'm relaxed and settled. And so how are you when you think? And are you anxious? Are you worried? You know, and can you somehow put to rest your anxiety? And in doing that, think much with greater clarity. Then the third thing is the content of what you're thinking about. So we can look at the content, you know, the ideas, the themes that we're thinking, and then you can begin exploring that and understanding it better, and make choices around that. You can choose, is this the right, wise thing to think about? And if it is the wise, appropriate thing to think about, how do I want to engage in this process of thinking? What is the right way to engage? And in different kind of situations and different kinds of things we have to think about, there's different appropriate ways to think, I believe. And so we have to have some discernment about, you know, what are you trying to think about right now? So sometimes it's really good to have the muse operate. We just kind of let creative, free flow thinking, kind of train associations, very creative, and it just kind of flows. And other times it's work to think. You actually don't want to be relaxed too much. You don't want to be tense, but it's actually more like work. You're kind of going through maybe systematically various questions. What am I thinking about? For what purpose am I thinking this? What are the assumptions that behind these kinds of thoughts? What are the beliefs? What are the biases and prejudices that are connected to it? Do I have all information? What information do I have? Let's line up the information I have so I get a full picture. Let's try to gather more information about this thing because I don't have enough information. So there's a lot of things we can do kind of to work, and that's appropriate sometimes with some activities. So what I'm suggesting is a wide range of ways to think, and part of the wisdom, hopefully your wisdom, is to know how, the appropriate way of thinking in different times. So the freer you are in relationship to thinking, the more flexibility you have to shift and change how you think at different times. Now, in the teachings of the Buddha, there's a very important term, which many of you are probably not familiar with, called yoniso manisikara. And manisikara could be translated as reflection. Reflection. Or attention. Or maybe for the purposes of tonight's talk, kind of reflection or attention. Turning the mind to address something, to look at something, to engage in something. Then the word yoniso is very interesting. The so part makes it yoni into an adjective. And yoni is the Indian word for womb, for a womb. And it also kind of has implications of the source. So it's kind of, so it's reflection or thinking about something from the source, from the womb, it's also considered to be this almost a synonym for wise. So it's often most common translation in English to English is wise reflection, wise attention. And the opposite, ayoniso manisikara, is unwise attention, unwise reflection. And so in the context of Buddhism, there's a discernment that's made. Is this wise? Does this come from the source? Is this going towards something that's healthy for us, this kind of thinking, or is it not? And from this kind of reflection, you know, what is healthy, what is appropriate, what comes from the source and what doesn't, it's very important in the Buddhist context and probably in all human context to, in critical thinking, is to ask, for what purpose am I thinking this? What purpose am I believing this? What purpose am I talking about this? What's the purpose? And if we borrow a little bit, expand a little bit, generalize, if I may, a little bit beyond Buddhism, but Buddhism would say the ultimate purpose, one way or other, is happiness, is to help human beings become happier. And so is the thing, what I'm engaging right now, some way or other, conducive to happiness? Does it touch into that source of motivation that leads to greater happiness for myself or to others? So no matter what we're engaging in, there can be this basic question. Is this conducive to happiness? You might say, well, that's simplistic or that's selfish. But remember, in Buddhism, we're just as much concerned about other people's happiness as our own. Not one or the other, but both. So is it for a greater happiness? So even someone who is engaged in anything, something that seems to have nothing to do with human happiness overtly, why are we doing it? Why do people do anything? Someone whose job is to be an engineer, well, is it to bring happiness to oneself or to others, and kind of making bridges, the theme of the weekend? Or is it... So it's a very interesting question. And this is what Buddhism suggests, at least, is you can always come back and reflect. What is the purpose for what you're thinking right now? And is the purpose one of bringing happiness? Moving in the direction of some form of happiness, well-being, the greater good. And if it is, then this is a good line of thinking. If it's not, do you have the ability to drop it, to change direction in your thinking? If you don't, then you need the first 3 weeks of this series of talks. Then you need to engage in the mindfulness practice to find how to become free. If you have the ability to drop the unhealthy thinking, it's not that leads in the opposite direction than happiness, then how do you engage with the content in a wise way? And there is a movement here in the West called critical thinking. And the word critical has the meaning of discerning. So thinking which is discerning, that's discriminating, that's analytical, that's kind of looks carefully at what it is that's being talked about or being thought out. And certainly different people have different natural capacities to more or less kind of analytical thinking. And you know, some people are much more scientifically oriented and they can think with greater clarity and systematically. And other people are less inclined to that. But no matter what, who you are, I think there's always a possibility of engaging with greater intelligent exploration of what you're thinking. To be a little bit more questioning. It's just simply to be questioning. To put a question mark. What is this? Is this really true? How do I know this? Is this, do I have all the information necessary to make this? Is this really a fact or is it an interpretation? Asking questions can be very, very helpful. The Buddha was the one who really tried to encourage people to think carefully and speak carefully, believe carefully. And one of the things that I'm fond of, one of the teachings of his that I'm fond of, having to do with this, again, this religion thing, he insisted that if you want to be a protector of the truth, safeguarding the truth, and you're doing a religious kind of life, then you should differentiate between statements you make based on what you know and statements you make based on what you believe, have faith in. And if you know it, then you can say, I know it. But if you don't know it, then say, I have it on faith. It's my belief that X, Y, and Z. And if you say it's my faith or my belief, then you're safeguarding the truth. Because you're not making a truth claim. You're just saying, I believe it's the case. But if you say this is the case, and you don't really know, then you're not safeguarding the truth. And I love that distinction. So to make a faith statement, and to know you're making it. And I meet lots and lots of religious people, and probably I do it in front of you here sometimes, I apologize, where we make statements that are faith statements, but we don't tell you that's the case. And so it sounds like we're holding forth, and this is the truth. And religious people, I've noticed, so I'm going to make one right now, religious people not only generalize, but they make declarative statements. And part of the strength and power of religious discourse sometimes, and the reason why some people get swept away in religious discourse and teachings, is because of the strength of the declarative statements. The person really knows this is how it is. But if you start questioning, how does this person really know it? On what basis? So here's an example of someone who made a declarative statement that was the Buddha pointed out was inappropriate. This kind of time, it was this fellow who thought he was the creator of the universe. You know, we have one, right? Usually one, we say one, right? So the creator, God. So back in ancient India, there was such a being called Brahma, and who was pretty confident he was the creator of the universe. Pretty big thing, right? And the Buddha came along and said, well, you know, actually, this was a misunderstanding on Brahma's part. and then the Buddha described, I don't know how the Buddha knew this, but I take it a little bit as a kind of fable. But there was a misunderstanding of, no, the creator of the universe is calling. You better be careful what I say. I wouldn't think the creator of the universe cared that much. But they, anyway, so this Brahma was, Buddha explained, this is how Brahma came to this misunderstanding. According to the ancient cosmology, mythology, the universe, as they knew it, the kind of creation and destruction of the universe followed the yo-yo theory of the universe. You know the yo-yo theory? Where the universe expands and then it contracts, expands and contracts. And nowadays science says it just expands, that's it. But back in ancient India, they believed in what we nowadays call the yo-yo theory. And in times of great contraction, or expansion, I forget which one it is, maybe both, there can't be any real life as we know it. However, beings don't disappear. Something like a disembodied consciousness continues to exist in some very rarefied, formless heavenly realm. And at some point, the world begins to reconstitute itself. The universe begins to reconstitute itself. And the first thing that happens in that reconstitution is that someone dies in this formless, you know, realm, and gets reborn in a coarser heaven. And the first person that dies and gets reborn in this coarser heaven looks around. There's no one else here. This is interesting. And this is kind of lonely. You know, it'd be really good if there were some other people around with me. And now it just happens that because the world is kind of reconstituting itself, just as he had that thought, someone else died and was reborn into that coarser heaven as well. And poof! You know, in front. Oh! I had that. What? Wow! I'm really powerful. I just made that person appear. But it was just a coincidence. He was lonely. And he thought it'd be nice to have someone here. And then this person died and got reborn. And so the person kept having these thoughts, and he kind of thought, "Oh, I'm the creator of the universe." And as the world reconstituted itself, he took credit. So this is how Brahma misunderstood that he was the creator of the universe. So it's kind of silly. I take it as a form of Buddhist humor. But it also, I think, is poking at the question of what basis do you believe something? Something as grand and big as the idea of a creator of a universe. Where's the authority for that? How does that come to be? Where is that source of knowledge coming from? Is it inference? Is it intuition? Is it because it just feels right? Is it feelings? Where does it come from? What's the source of authority? So critical thinking is questioning, upon what authority do I believe something? What authority do I think something? What's going on here? Some people would rather not do that kind of intellectual work. They'd rather be spoon-fed their spirituality, to have a feel-good kind of spirituality. It doesn't require any kind of work. It doesn't require any kind of intelligence. I feel that very strongly that Buddhist practice needs all our intelligence. We're not expected to ignore our intelligence, but engage our intelligence in all the aspects of it for the purposes of engaging in the path, for the purposes of helping promote greater good, greater happiness in this world. But as we use all our intelligence, means also to use it intelligently. So that as we use our intelligence, including our thinking, we're using it in such a way that it doesn't agitate us, it doesn't stress us out, it doesn't constrict us, but actually leads to a real sense of happiness and peace and well-being. And my own feeling is that as we keep really good critical thinking and good critical thinking ability can dramatically help us in the process of becoming more peaceful, living a more peaceful life within ourselves and also a more peaceful life in relationship to other people. Critical thinking, the kind of careful analysis and understanding of what we believe and what we think and what we're all about, can lead to a greater sense of harmony and well-being with others. When we don't live in an unexamined life, will probably be a life of conflict. Unless you sit watching television all day, then you know you're staying out of trouble. What kind of statement was that? So in thinking about this talk today, I googled critical thinking. And what came up was the Wikipedia description of critical thinking. And in the very opening kind of description of critical thinking, somewhat to my surprise, it describes some of the key elements of critical thinking. And the first one is it was humbleness, to be humble. That's good. Isn't that something? So critical thinking requires certain humility or humbleness that you don't know. So it allows you to question and explore more. The second one, which also surprised me, was empathy. And that's a surprise because, the association of critical thinking is this kind of aloof, dry kind of intellect that is kind of calculating and, no touch with the emotions at all. But to have empathy as part of it, I think, is very important. And then it went on and on talking about it's very important in critical thinking to understand your biases, your prejudices, and your blind spots. That's a really important part of it. But the empathy was good, because one of the functions of mindfulness and also critical thinking is to understand the relationship between our emotions and our thoughts, our emotions and what we believe. And for some people, there's a very, very strong relationship to it. And sometimes that relationship is not a very healthy one. Sometimes people will pursue what feels good, and their beliefs and their thoughts are a slave or are being directed by the pursuit of what feels good. And I've seen people with tremendous intellects tremendously powerful intellects and powerful personalities use kind of a lawyer's, use the best senses of the term lawyer, the lawyer's ability to really lay out a case that was completely self-serving. That, the person could easily the next day, if the whole situation changed, or the desires changed, or the wishes, or the pursuit of pleasure changed, could come with a whole very tight, powerful case of why this other thing was right now. So it's being directed by our feelings, by what feels good, rather than... So part of, I think, critical thinking is to have a really good sense or handle on emotions and to see the connection between emotions and the world of thinking. So I believe that mindfulness is a great aid to critical thinking. I think critical thinking is a great aid to mindfulness. I think the Buddhist path was laid out to include the ability to think discriminatingly or clearly or discerningly, and then to know when to put it to rest, when that kind of thinking doesn't serve us. And especially in meditation practice, our intelligence can help us quite a bit, our thinking and discerning quite a bit, and help us sort through all the different hindrances to meditation that crop up. But at some point, we also have to learn how to put it all down. And so we can have some experience of a state of well-being or happiness that is one of the greatest that a person can experience. And if you can experience real happiness, real embodied, heartfelt, deep, core happiness within us, then you have a reference point for answering the question, the critical thinking kind of question, for what purpose am I thinking this? If you know what happiness is, it gives you kind of a lighthouse that you can kind of aim towards. If you don't know what happiness is, then you don't have that, and your thinking will probably be much more muddled. So I hope that this evening's talk was worthy of a talk on critical thinking. I hope I just didn't blow it by a lot of declarative statements, unacknowledged faith statements, muddled thinking, and imprecise statements, you know, all this stuff. But if I had all those faults, please forgive me. But the lesson, I think, you can take anyway. Thank you.